we go.
Monday, we talked about Daniel, didn't we? The Walk Daniel and Walk Believer song, remember? Yeah. Was that this class?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
You never done Walk Daniel?
Yes.
Yes. When you flew?
Yes.
Oh, okay, we done talked about Daniel. We talked about, you know, the songs that we do with all the history, you can see how the slaves and the black people had to depend on the Lord for survival. And that's how they did. That's why spiritual music is a very important part of our background, as well as singing. Let me see now. Okay, we've talked about the islands and how my ancestors were brought there. And now we're going to talk about Dutch heritage. It's on the mainland. Because, see, a lot of those people that were brought right there on the islands, right there on the Atlantic Ocean, they sold them into the mainland and sold them all over the South. And Doug's family was in the southwest part of Georgia. And that's around Albany, Georgia. Anyone know where Albany is? Okay, he lived like 15 miles, in 15 miles? 16 miles south, how could I forget that? 16 miles south of Albany, it's a little town called Bakerton, Georgia. And he's going to tell you, okay, I thought she was saying something. He's going to tell you about something about the heritage there that's very interesting.
As on the island, she had said the other day that after slavery, slave owners gave land to the slaves there because they didn't realize that they would ever be, they didn't think that they'd ever be able to live on those lands because of the mosquito bites. But in the area where I came from, they didn't give them anything. So that's how really sharecropping began to come plentiful. And some of those people back in those days did have their own land. Some of the blacks did have their own land. Those that had their own land fared a lot better. And then there was some slave owners, very, very, very few, that gave the slave a little spot of land. They also, some of them would call themselves being good to them, give them a few chickens to get started, you know, give them a little this and a little that, to get them started to help themselves. And some of them just did whatever the master gave them after freedom, they didn't try to increase it. Some did. So that's how some got up, some were down. And that's why a lot of, as I say, a lot of our sharecroppers. So we sharecropped in that area. And in the year of 1952, well, I was a small boy, my teenage, and I would go out and I'd help my uncles to plow. And that's how I learned to plow, by staying out with them plowing. And so outside one year, I went sharecropping because I thought they were getting along real good. They didn't let me know that they were getting along bad. We would walk along because we have a song that we sang about the sharecropper song of being. And I guess it come from that time and how they would say this, walk, lift your head up and walk spry and smile if you don't even have a penny in your pocket. So just don't show that you're down all the time. So that's the way they did. So I thought they were making plenty of money, you know. And so outside I sharecropped, me and my mother, sisters and brothers. So when the end of the year came, to settle up. We worked hard all year long. There's many days that I went to work early in the morning dusting cotton. You had to dust cotton when the dew was on the leaves. And when the sun comes up and starts drying the dew off the cotton, then you stop dusting. Then you hook up to a hammer stock or turn fly, whatever, then you ply the rest of the day. Fly all day until late in the evening when the dew starts falling, then you hook up to the cotton duster again and you dust cotton until about 12 o'clock at night. Especially when the moon is shining, when it's a full moon and shining, then you can dust cotton up until about 12 o'clock at night or longer, all night if you felt like it. And you go home, you sleep until about 4 o'clock, and you get up and you go out and dust cotton again until the sun rises and drops. Then you start flying again. This will happen all during the summer long. You dust the peanuts and everything. It's like that. And also to tobacco. Well, the tobacco, you can do that most any time because you spray that, you spray your poison on the tobacco to kill the worm and thing with water. It mixes that up. But the cotton was a dust, so it wouldn't stick on the leaves. It wasn't any dew on the leaves. And after that, we worked hard all year long. That year we had best crops in that area. My uncle was at, we had a part of the cropping. Me and my mother and sister and brother had another part of the farm. And that year we was making a ton and a half of peanuts to an acre. And we're making a bale and a half of cotton to the acre. Had big, nice, yellow leaves on the tobacco without any holes because the hail didn't come, so they didn't knock any holes in the leaves. Corn was 3 to 4 years to the stalk. Every once in a while you see a stalk of corn had 2 years, but it was 3 to 4. And I mean good, nice, big ears of corn. And at the end of the year, after everything had been harvested and in, well, I went to Albany. We was living in Bakerland, so I decided I'd go to Albany that morning happy because my mother was going to get settled up that morning with the man that was cropping that year. And I went home and I went to Albany and I was happy. I was all in Albany because my mother had told me she was going to give me a good little bit of money. She said, I'm going to give you, if we make anything, I'm going to give you $100. Now, $100 those days was money. That was like about $1 million. It's back in the 59, 52. So to me, it was like $1 million. So I went on to Albany that day, that morning, about 11 o'clock. I caught the bus and went to Albany. And I was just up in Albany. I was figuring out what I was going to do with my money when I get back home. So I was going to catch the 5 o'clock bus south going back home. And my sister, she had come from home. She was on the 4:30 bus that got in Albany. They come at the same time. She was getting off and I was getting on another one. She said, well, we got the settlement. I said, you do? We do. She said, yeah. I said, how much you were? She said, $925. I thought she was talking about $925. She didn't tell me no different. When I got home and I went to my mother, I said, oh, got some? She said, yeah. I said, how much was it? She said, $9.25. I said, what? She said, $9.25. Right then, you know what flew into me? I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill that man, but my mother, you know, had more insight than I did. I'm young. She had more insight than I did. She said, no, don't bother. See, the Lord will take care of him. Don't bother this. We just won't work for him anymore. So what had happened during that time, I little jitterbug, I had a hawkbill knife, you know, hawkbill knives, and I kept it razor sharp. And he had a little store, and I was going to go down there. The way I figured out how I was going to do it, I was going to go down there, and I was going to say, I want a piece of candy right there. And when he go down to get that candy, I come out my pocket with it open. And I was going to start whacking until he was gone. But she said, don't do that. Don't do that. See, she knew if I'd have did him like that, the whole family would have got destroyed. So I didn't. So that was the part of my life story. And now I moved to Brunswick.
Tell them what. Who knows what sharecropping is? Everybody doesn't know what sharecropping is.
But you know, another thing is some people may not know how big a bale of cotton is.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I know. I have seen that, but some people may think of like a bale of hay, or they may think bale of straw. They may not know how big.
To get a bale of cotton, a bale of cotton is from 500 or more pounds in the cotton after it had been ginned. In order to get that 500 pounds, you had to pick 1,500 pounds of cotton And when they get the dirt, you know, a little sand that's be in it and whatever, the trash out of it and the seeds out of it, and they press it down into a big bale. It'd be about that tall, about that wide, and about that thick. And they have iron steel bands around it. And that is a bale of cotton. So you have to pick 1,500 pounds of raw cotton to get the 500 pounds of natural cotton after you take the seeds out. So that's what a bale of cotton is. Not like a box, because you can get a bale of hay, it'll be about 75 to 100 pounds. So that's a bale of hay. But a bale of cotton is more pounds.
What sharecropping is?
Sharecropping is that a person owns land and needs someone to work it. So what will happen, they will get together with a person that don't have any land, tell them, you work the land, I furnish the seeds and the mules and the land, and you furnish all the labor. And when the end of the year comes, he will take out his expense. Whatever the expense is, after that, whatever's left over, they're supposed to divide it equally. If it was $1,000, the person that worked the land is supposed to get $500, and the one that furnished the land and the seeds is supposed to get $500. But it didn't always work that way, because as I said, me and my mother and eight sisters and brothers, we only got $9.25 for that whole year working. My uncle worked for the same man, so you know he had the same kind of crop that we had, because we was all on the same place. And he only made $10 and a quarter. He only made a dollar more than we did. And in that area, there was a man that owned the turpentine business. And he had his own money that he had made up that he would pay his hands off with. And they couldn't spend it anywhere else but in his store. He also had a store called a commissary. So they could only spend the money in his store. And in order to get money to go to other stores to get other foods or clothing, they would have to trade this money that Babbitt, they call it, Babbitt money. They would have to trade it for some real American money. And so in order to trade it, they would have to give a person a dollar in Babbitt for 50 cents in American money. And so they got the tail end of everything. And mostly in those kind of stores, you know, the meat is not good. He had the worst meat and anything else. The only thing that was good was the canned goods. And so if they wanted good meat, they had to trade the Babbitt for some American money. Now the Babbitt, this is something years ago they had a machine in the bus stations that you would go there and you put your money in and you make your tag, put your name and your address on it and all. But his money looked something like this. Right here, and I didn't have hold of it, it was solid. It was just that light, and it called back. He had on one side, he had his name and the company, J.R. Miller and Summers. And on the other side, he had the amount of what the money was. He had different sizes, 50 cents, he had up to a dollar. Dollar, 50 cents, quarter, dimes, and nickels. He didn't have any paper money of his own that he made. And pennies, now if he paid it off in pennies, he would give you that in American money, pennies, it was two or three pennies. But if it got up to a nickel, you got that nickel in Babbitt. That's what they called it, Babbitt.
So tell them what year this was in,
back in the early part of the 50s.
That wasn't a long time ago. No.
So what you guys live on, I mean, you didn't have any money.
Well, that was where we didn't stay on this place. We didn't work for him. So therefore, when we worked for someone, we got cash money. So we go to any store that we. But the people that stayed on this place and worked for him in the turpentine woods, that's when they would get paid off in that kind of money, because
he had his own money.
He had his own business. He also had the steel there where he was processing the turpentine for the first processing. Then it was put it in barrels and sent it somewhere else for when they get the other processes. But right there, he would do some of it right there.
But when you were sharecropping, you got your money at the end of the season or whatever. Well, what did you eat on?
That's what I was referring to.
Did they feed you, or did you? Where'd you get the
Now, that's a good question, because, see, a lot of time when people sharecrop with a person, they lives on the land, and also the person would, you know, doing all during the day, would loan them, all during the year, would loan them money to go and purchase, to go to the store and things. And so that would eat up most of their money like that. But, and this, my uncle lived on the man place, but we didn't live on this place. We lived elsewhere. And then by so many of us, sometimes we would get our work caught up and we would go work for someone else. So that kind of helped us through the year to survive without having to go to him to borrow money to go and purchase other things.
Sometimes at the end of the year you owed him money.
Huh?
If you ate all that money up.
Right.
Or borrowing money.
Yeah, that's a lot of them come out that way. Old money instead of getting anything. The old money, but the thing about it, we wasn't living on this place and we wasn't going down to the store credit and this and that and other, because we would work with other people and make extra money. Because a lot of times we would catch up with our work. Sometimes we didn't have work to do, you know, we didn't have to do any work at our farm in a week and a half, because we caught up with the whole one. So we go out to other people and hold cotton and we get paid like that, so that kind of help us through the year, so we didn't have to go to him and borrow money.
Were there any songs you sang while doing that
work? Huh? Was there any music that you sang while doing that work?
Oh, we didn't sing. We didn't sing.
You see how
light
that is?
That should have been illegal for him to have his own money. But back there in that area, they could do anything that they wanted to do. They'll tell about how the black people.
That wasn't so many years.
There was a show on PBS about how they come into the cities and they get people who don't have work and they bring them out to plantations. It's just like migrant workers. Mm-hmm. Bring them to plantations. They still have a company store. They have substandard living conditions and they can only buy in the company store because they're in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. They don't have transportation.
And they even give them crack. And these people just wind up owing the store money, and it's still going on today. And I had a guy on from the Department of Labor. I think it was on 60 Minutes. They had a guy from the Department of Labor, the head of the Department of Labor, and they asked him, "Well, how many cases have you prosecuted?" And he said, "None. The Department of Justice has to prosecute them, and they haven't. There isn't a single case that's been prosecuted." And then if somebody loses their license to be able to be a supervisor of the migrant workers, like there was one guy who lost his license, his wife just got a license.
Not only that, did the blacks was treated that way in our area, all a poor white folk would be that way too. And they would do, in that time, they would do just like the slaves did. They would do just like the slaves. You know, slaves are made up songs, games, and dances as a way of protest to the master and overseers. And this is the way that they couldn't go to them and fight them about it, because they didn't have no, as the old folks say, not a leg to stand on. So how they would get back, even the whites and the blacks, sometimes how they would get back after those people that do them like that. Like if I worked this year and I didn't clear anything, or maybe he would tell me and say, "Well, you about $200 or $300 in the hole. You owe me $200 or $300. So I got to work for him another year. So what would happen? I go on just like, and this also I've seen white people do the same thing. In my time, I saw them do just what the blacks would do, the same thing, because I was working, we were staying in little town of Bakersfield, and we would go out to the farms in the mornings, you know, to do work. And what they would do, they worked that farm all year long just as happy as if nothing happened. The whites would do the same thing. And when time to harvest that farm, they leave by night. Leave it there in the ground. I've seen white people do this also, as well as I saw blacks. And what would happen, they would see another man, seem like the people that work for him is getting along real good, so they would ask somebody working with him. So what happened, he would loan them his truck if they don't have any way of means of moving. He would loan them his truck at night, and they would move in the middle of the night. And when the boss man, when the man on the land come out the next morning, there's no one to gather the crop. They have moved. I went out to work, and leave that evening, coming home and go back the next morning, the house is empty. People gone. People are gone. Not only the blacks, the white would do the same thing. And so that was a way of getting back at them, but not, you know, because they could have given them something and not take it all from them.
You know, the kind of same thing. And Miss Bessie Jones, who we started traveling with 20 years ago, she's from the area that Doug is from up there around Dawson, Georgia. And she said her mother and stepfather sharecropped. And she said the man kept saying to them, let's not sell the cotton now. They had already harvested the cotton, whatever you do with it, and had it in the barn or in somewhere waiting, you know, for the cotton crop money to go up. So he kept saying, let's not do it now. We don't want to sell it now. We're going to wait until the price go up. And she said one night that man went in the barn late at night, got the cotton and hauled it away on a truck, set the barn on fire. And the next morning when they got up and went out there, so he said, well, we're going to lose the crop this year because the barn burned down and the cotton burned down with it. So you owe us. You're going to have to stay with me another year. But she said he didn't have sense enough to know that they went into the ashes looking for those steel bands. And it wasn't any steel band because the steel don't burn. And that's how they knew what he had done. And so they said they just packed up that stuff that night and just left. But like Doug said, it wasn't only just black people treated like that. Poor white people had a hard time too.
This was also true. This was not, I mean, in our country, it was both black and white, but in England, in the coal mines, and in the mines there, the owners of the mines not only owned the houses, but a miner was, if he broke the shovel, he was charged for that. The same thing happened. But if he quit, the whole family was thrown out of the house because it was company property.
Yes.
This is a universal sub-slavery kind.
That's right.
The gimmicks were all there to get around any justice. There wasn't any.
That's right.
The story makes me think of Jacob, and I'm Jacob and Laban, and I'm wondering if there are any stories about, you know, how he had to work. He tried to work 7 years for one daughter, and then he got the great switcheroo.
I mean, Esau and Jacob, and Isaac, Esau. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
That's a different story.
Yeah.
He's talking about they've worked 7 years for
daughter. Yeah, for the daughter, yeah. But poor Jacob really got it, didn't he? That man made him work. That woman should have been worth it all, I tell you.
So, you came from the islands.
See, that's what I was telling you all yesterday. On the islands was a better place to live. Rather than, and that shows you what I was telling you yesterday, it was a better place to live up and down the Atlantic Ocean than it was to live there, you know, further in the mainland, way in the mainland. And even today, it's still like this. It really is. It's almost like this today. Down in, it was national news once. Forsyth, Georgia. No blacks can live there. And, you know, you would think in this day and time that this wouldn't be possible, but they just can't. I mean, it's just, and that's almost in that part of Georgia. It's that middle, there in that middle and that southwest part of Georgia, it was just bad. It was just a bad place to live.
I said Forsyth, Georgia. I mean Forsyth County.
Yeah. So if you are from the island and you're from southwestern Georgia, how did you meet?
In church.
You must have a big church.
Well, I came to the islands. I first came to the islands in 1956, and I stayed about 6 or 7 months. And I left and went back home, and I came back in 63, and that's where I've been ever since. That's where we met in the last part of 63.
Yes, People Magazine talks about it, that I walked in church with a red dress on. Instead of talking about Ebo's Landing, they talked about me walking in with a red dress on.
I was singing in a quartet.
And I heard him sing the song. They got up to sing, and he was singing. I saw the group that was from Brunswick, and it was used to be with the older men. And I didn't know that these younger men was in this group. Because that night, I said, I don't want to go to church. I said, I don't want to hear them old men sing.
You heard you wore a red dress.
What was that song Jay sang? Unclouded Day. I said, that's all they sing. I don't want to go. And so they had a group from Miami, Florida, Miami, Florida. So that's why I was going, you know. But then when I saw him, I thought he was with the people from Miami, Florida. And then when the groups got up to sing, the group from Brumsey got up to sing, I was living on St. Simon then, he got up with them. And he sung the song, Family Circle. And that took it. That put the icing on the cake. I just happened to have this man. But if any of you all...
I want to... Did you go to St. Simon's the first time to leave the sharecropping area? Was that an option to go to St. Simon's? It might be better for you.
Yeah.
Did a lot of people go there?
Here you were
with your mother.
That's a better place.
As long as you stayed in Southwest Georgia, you were trapped.
That's right.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Was your reason to go to St. Simon's?
My reason.
You might have more chance.
More chance, a free man to do as I please. First time I came to Brunswick in 55 was during the 4th of July. You know, doing that stuff, I had an uncle come from Philadelphia, and he came home to visit, so he got a sister, my aunt, who lived in Brunswick. So we went down there just for 4th of July, and I kind of liked it, Brunswick, so I went back in October to live. And I got down there, my mother, she was still living at the time, and I just got homesick, so I left in April, the first of April, April day I left, came back home, and that's why I married and everything, and stayed there. This is 56, and I stayed there till 63, and I left and come back to Brunswick. That's where I've been ever since. Because things, in other words, in Brunswick, there's a better chance for even black or white.
That's on
the coast. There are. I often tell people when we go all around the United States, if a person goes into Glynn County in Brunswick, in that area, he cannot make a living, he's just sorry, he's lazy. Because there is a living, there's a whole lot going on.
They live off the water.
They live off the water. They live off. There's industry there. There's a lot of tourists. That's right. Golf courses and motels and restaurants.
She said
there
was women with the red dresses.
So it can make a living there in Brunswick with all these.
If anyone would like to get a picture of us, like this, they're a dollar. Most people say. We got the tapes and the albums with the songs and games on them. And if you'd like to have a picture of us, an autographed picture, with us dressed like the master and the overseer. This is a switch. And that's why I had this picture plastered all over Oakland, California. And if you'd like to have an autographed picture today or tomorrow, it's a dollar and we'll autograph it for you. And if you'd like to get some of the tapes, they're $10 each with the Gullah language and whatever, the games and songs. And we do have a sharecropping song. Ooh, I'll make you all late for lunch.
I have two questions, and maybe you don't need to answer them now, but maybe before the week's over. You were going to tell us about Nat Jim Crow. But also, you mentioned yesterday about Pat and Juba, and a little bit about the difference between that and Hambo. If you could talk
we'll
a little more
that
about
tomorrow.
that would be great.
Would you all like to hear about that?
Oh, yes.
The Knock Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And Juba. So don't let us forget that. Okay. You better go get in line for lunch. But if anyone would like to get a picture.